Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ken Rudin.
And I'm Don Gagne, filling in for Ron Elving.
Don, as you know, Ron has actually been parachuted off the coast of Costa Rica. He's going to be part of I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. Then we have some presidential news. The president is heading off to Mexico this week.
It's his first visit there as president. He'll meet with President Calderon there. And then it's off to Trinidad, Tobago, where the Summit of the Americas is going to be taking place. All of the American nations will be there, Latin American, North American, Central American, save one, Cuba.
In Mexico, I assume they're not talking as much about immigration policy. I think the president said the other day that he will address that issue perhaps next month in May. But right now, there's other things. It's the porous border. It's crime and drugs.
The Obama administration likes to take kind of a broad, holistic view of these things. And immigration is certainly part of it. But this week, they've been talking about border issues, beefing up the U.S. effort along the border. But there's also a crackdown, if that's the right word, an enhanced effort on the part of the White House to get at these big drug lords and drug cartels and the weapons. It's interesting, though, when the U.S. talks about the drug issue, we've heard it from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. We've heard it from the president himself that the U.S. does bear responsibility.
We're the buyers.
We are the buyers. We create a demand.
And there's also been a slew of articles in the paper talk about the easy access. I mean, I don't want to be part of the it's all our fault, but it is true that with easy access to assault weapons throughout Texas, for example, it's easy for the drug cartels to just go in and just purchase these guns, right? Was it Calderon or somebody who called for reinstituting the ban on assault weapons?
Yes, and what it shows is the problem isn't just what crosses the U.S.-Mexican border into the U.S., but it's what goes the other way.
And obviously, it's just not about Mexico. You talked about all Latin American, South American countries, except for Cuba. Now, we have some kind of a shift in Cuba going on. Of course, the younger generation has taken over. 77-year-old Raul Castro has replaced 81-year-old Fidel Castro, but some shift in U.S. policy, it seems like.
The president had a major announcement regarding Cuba this week, and it was not that the doors are open, that the long-standing embargo is over. It remains in place, except Cuban Americans who have family in Cuba are now able to visit freely. They are able to send money. They are going to be able to reestablish personal relationships in person, literally. And that is a pledge that candidate Obama made last year, and he has made good on it. The Cuban reaction is that it is a good thing.
Good first step.
It is a good first step, but only a small first step.
It's also interesting to see what kind of reaction we'll get in Congress. Some Republicans have praised this move, whereas Robert Menendez, the Cuban-American senator from New Jersey, Democrat, said that this is the wrong way to go. So it's interesting that it's not predictable by party.
It has always been wrapped up as well in Florida politics.
Right.
Florida being a swing state, it all comes back to that somehow.
Left unsaid, or not left unsaid, but another problem certainly that the Obama administration has to deal with is Venezuela.
Hugo Chavez,
right,
the president of Venezuela, will be at the Summit of the Americas. President Obama will see him there. They're not going to have one of those one-on-one bilateral meetings where they bring in the press and you get all the photos. But I can tell you their meeting, and it'll likely be on the sidelines as broader discussions are taking place, will be one of the most talked about things. How will President Obama approach him?
Here's one foreign policy success I think the president can be proud of is what happened with those pirates off the Somali coast.
There was a great deal of praise for how President
deservedly
Obama
so
handled this. And while the crisis, I think we can call it that, was underway, certainly it was a very volatile, symbolic, too, international crisis that he had to deal with. There was talk about how he hadn't said anything, how he wasn't out there visibly. He wasn't issuing ultimatums. He was being briefed and kept very closely apprised of everything that was going on. And ultimately, a mission is judged by its outcome. There it is.
Absolutely. I agree completely. I mean, if you think of the Pueblo, the ship that was taken by the North Koreans in 1968, if you think of the Mayaguez during the Ford administration, you think of the downed helicopters in Iran during the Carter administration.
You think of Black Hawk Down.
Right, exactly, in Somalia. You think of failures. And obviously this, and of course, if this turned out bad, if something went wrong, if the captain had been shot or killed or anything like that, of course, President Obama probably would have been blamed for it. But everything seemed to work exactly according to plan.
And he has made clear this does not solve the problem of piracy off the coast of Somalia or wherever. But the White House says it does send a very strong message.
Now, of course, the pirates do not represent the government. Certainly, there's no government to speak of in Somalia. But there are other governments acting with impunity, not exactly in accord with U.S. foreign policy, say North Korea.
North Korea is walking away from the six-party talks with its neighboring countries, South Korea, China, Russia, and, of course, the U.S., all aimed at getting Kim Jong-il to walk away from his nuclear ambitions. And obviously, this is the one big card he has to play. And he has shown no willingness to give up that card. And we have seen him in a very provocative way try to test the new Obama administration. There was the failed missile test.
Exactly.
And now there is the pronouncement that they are walking away from the six-party talks. The fear is not so much that North Korea is going to launch a missile with a nuclear warhead that is going to hit Alaska. The fear is what a nuclear-capable North Korea would mean when it comes to that broader issue of nuclear proliferation. There would be the most destructive weapons imaginable, more of them out there, and with someone like North Korea for sale on the market and far more likely to fall into the hands of a terrorist group, perhaps.
And then another foreign policy dilemma or some kind of a thing that the Obama administration has to deal with is the latest notice by Iran that American/Iranian journalist has now been held on espionage charges.
And apparently going on trial, a closed trial. So we cannot observe in the West what is happening there. Again, there are broader, very complicated issues with Iran. But this is one of those kinds of stories that really does focus the public's attention. And it can make the U.S. seem helpless in a way.
One thing, coming back to home, one thing that seemed to have attracted much attention among some in the American political spectrum were this week's tea parties held on April 15th, obviously commemorating Tax Day.
Harkening back to the Boston Tea Party, it's interesting. There were protests, somewhat 750 of them around the country. It was portrayed as a very grassroots thing, seeming in a lot of ways to want to kind of mimic the local events that President Obama and even his campaign.
And the MoveOn.org people.
And the MoveOn.org people. They were portrayed as bipartisan. They did not seem as such.
To me, bipartisan means Democrats and Republicans. I think that a lot of the rhetoric I saw and much of the coverage, and of course not all the networks covered it the same. Obviously, Fox News covered it far more in-depth. They had anchors everywhere. I mean, you know, these guys were out there, whereas the other cable networks seemed to mock it. Of course, look, most of it was anti-Obama because he's the president, but a lot of stuff was anti-Bush, anti-Wall Street. It almost seemed more like a Ron Paul event than it was a Republican-sponsored event, even though the GOP would certainly like to take any credit to get any benefit out of it they could.
It's interesting, too, though, with the economy where it is and so many people just terrified about their jobs, with the government pouring massive amounts of stimulus into the economy. 61% of Americans, in polling done in the last week or two, feel that the amount of income tax they pay is about fair. If you go back a decade, when we were kind of on the eve of the George W. Bush presidency, Bill Clinton still in office.
The Gingrich Revolution.
Only 45% said they felt like the amount they were taxed was fair. That's a significant spread there, 15% more. So that does make it harder for protests like this to really gain steam. Okay, so Ken, we have all been watching Minnesota. I was going to say with bated breath, but I think we ran out of breath a long time ago if we were holding it, kind of waiting for a result. Al Franken about to be sworn in as a United States senator?
Well, let's put it this way. I think it's looking good for Al Franken. About to be sworn in, that's the problem. And the problem is that even though the three-judge panel this week has said, look, Al Franken got the most votes. He got 312 more votes than Norm Coleman. The vote has been fair. The vote has been thorough. The vote has been accurate. Al Franken deserves to win this. Norm Coleman and his attorney Ben Ginsburg said from the beginning that there are still at least 1,000, if not thousands, of disenfranchised voters in Minnesota whose votes have not been counted, and he will take his appeal to the state Supreme Court.
We know Ben Ginsburg from Florida 2000.
That's
right. He was one of then-governor and candidate Bush's
And that
wives.
Only lasted 46 days, I think, or whatever, 67 days, I think it was. And this one is, I think, over 160 days since the November 4th election with no sign of letting up yet, because there are some Republicans, like John Cornyn, the head of the NRSC, who says, look, let's go to the U.S. Supreme Court if we have to. I suspect that if the state Supreme Court turns down Coleman, Governor Tim Pawlenty, the Republican, will certify the election. Now, it'll be interesting to see what happens in Washington if they try to seat Franken, whether there's a Republican filibuster. I suspect that the state Supreme Court will be the final arbiter. If they say no, it's been fair, it's been thorough, it's been accurate, it's time to give it up, as you know, a lot of Democrats have been. The DNC, matter of fact, has an ad out this week urging Norm Coleman to pack it in.
So Norm Coleman's Senate office is closed.
Well, right. His term ended January
3rd.
Right. I mean, there's only one senator, Amy Klobuchar, who has been, you know, carrying the workload since January 3rd, only one senator. Of course, the famous New Hampshire story in 1975, we had one senator until September without getting a final outcome until they had a special election, a do-over election. That's not going to happen here. It looks like that Al Franken will be the next senator. And there's also news in New York 20, the Democrat, Scott Murphy, may be the next congressman from New York 20.
Okay, so this is the Gillibrand seat. She is the U.S. Senator from New York, having replaced Hillary Clinton.
That's correct. Republicans say do not be premature with this because Saratoga County, which is the big county in upstate New York, which is big to disco country, those absentee ballots have not come in yet. And now they have come in. And ultimately, right now, as of we're speaking, Scott Murphy has an 86-vote lead.
Okay, so
landslide Scott, we call it.
But there's an interesting new little sidebar to this. Gillibrand's vote has been called into question, her ballot.
Well, exactly. Now, Gillibrand, who expected to be in Washington, or at least out of the district on Election Day, which is March 31st, applied for an absentee ballot, received it, and voted by absentee. Now, the Republicans say, well, this is not fair because she actually turned up in the district on Election Day. Now, first of all, Gillibrand says, one, I was not in the district. Two, I didn't expect to be there in time. And, of course, if you don't know if you're going to be in there, to be safe, you vote absentee to make sure your vote counts. What's also interesting about this is that Jim Todisco is not a resident of the 20th District. They redrew the lines that he's outside the boundaries. So they're fighting over Kirsten Gillibrand's absentee vote, whereas Todisco couldn't even vote for himself. Of course, if Todisco loses by one vote, that would be pretty remarkable.
I can't follow any of that. Just to be perfectly clear here, we do know the name Bloomberg in New York.
We do.
He's the mayor.
And by all accounts, he's done a great job. And it's a city that was thought to be ungovernable. Ed Koch kind of screwed it up in the late 1980s. David Dinkins, by most accounts, did a poor job. It was Rudy Giuliani who began to see the way of making New York somewhat governable, albeit at the expense of constitutional rights. But who cares about that? Because, you know, that's unimportant. But what's interesting is that Bloomberg, of course, was a Democrat for most of his life. He ran in 2001 as a Republican because he knew he could never get the Democratic nomination.
So it was the path to a nomination to get on the ballot in the general election.
And win, because he won in 2001. He was reelected overwhelmingly in 2005. But then in 2007, he said, you know something, I think I want to be president of the United States, and I'm pro-choice, I'm anti-gun, I'm pro-stem cells, I'm pro-gay rights. That's not going to give me the Republican nomination, so I'll switch to become an independent. So he became an independent for the last couple of years.
And never did launch that presidential bid. That we
no,
were
as a matter of fact, I checked the newspapers. Obama was elected president.
I think I've heard that.
And so Bloomberg now says, well, wait a second. I don't know if I could win as an independent. The Democrats are going to put up probably a strong candidate. So what I'm going to do is try to get on the ballot, at least as a Republican, the party he denounced basically in 2007, the last couple of years. And now it looks like, because to get on the ballot in New York, on the Republican ballot, you need a majority of the county leaders backing your candidacy. He got the backing of Staten Island, Brooklyn, and the Bronx. And now it looks like that he will be the Republican nominee once again for a third term.
And does the Republican Party welcome him?
You know what they welcome? They welcome his $800 gazillion. And that's exactly what it is. And if they, if Bloomberg as a Republican can bring along some Republicans along with him on the ballot, God bless. But, I mean, ideologically, there really isn't any ideological purity in New York anymore. First of all, the Liberal Party, which no longer exists, was not liberal. And the Republican Party is basically a mockery of what it once was. They used to have in New York Republicans like Jacob Javits and Nelson Rockefeller and Kenneth Keating and John Lindsay and Giuliani. But for the most part, the Republican Party, look, there's only three Republicans in the 29-seat congressional delegation in New York. That shows how far the Republican Party has fallen in the Empire State.
Okay, so let's go from Bloomberg to Blagojevich, a name that just keeps giving.
Keeps on giving. Of course, the latest story was that, you know, he pled not guilty to the 16 felony counts. And I guess the trial could be anywhere from a year to 2 years from now. But he's been saying not guilty since he was arrested, basically. And now it's official that he pled not guilty.
And he's lost his job. He's no longer governor.
Right.
Of
he was impeached, convicted, and removed from office.
His trial, a couple years away. A man has to make a living.
Well, he does have an opportunity. And, Don, you want to tell us what that is?
A game show? A reality
show? It's
a
reality TV show. I'm a celebrity. Get me out of here. It's sort of like the podcast. On TV. And I guess the thrust of the show, as I understand it, is that they're going to airlift him into the jungles of Costa Rica, and he's going to have to deal with the terrain there. And that's what the former governor, who had White House ambitions, is not going to be doing until...
Is he going to join one of these ninth grade class trips to Costa Rica and do the zip line over the rainforest?
That's
and all
what
it
sounds
stuff?
Like. And yet, of course, he has to get a judge's permission because to leave the country. And what if he doesn't come back? Then what are we going to talk about?
So celebrity is celebrity is celebrity. It doesn't matter why. It doesn't matter how. People will tune in?
They will. And you know something, just thinking about celebrity, and this is not politics, but we talked about the Pirates and we talked about the Twins, meaning Coleman and Franken. For a second, I just want to end this with talking about the Tigers. I know Don Gagne, White House correspondent, known for his political acumen and, you know, coverage of presidents past and present. But you're also a lifelong Detroit Tigers fan, and somebody in the Tigers family left us this week.
Mark the Bird Fidrich. When he came along, the Tigers were just, I mean, there had been some bad Tiger teams of late. But in 1975, 76, they were as bad as they've ever been. And, you know, in baseball, it's the old cliche, but hope springs eternal. We always hope something will happen this year. So in 1976, along comes this kid, 21 years old, out of the minor leagues, wasn't there at the start of the year, didn't come up till the middle of May, and he gets on the mound for his first start, and he's talking to the baseball, and he's on his knees, and he's, like, grooming the mound, filling in the holes. This is between pitches, not between innings. If it wasn't just right, he got down on his knees. And Mark Fidrich was just this joyous presence that caught on not just in Detroit, but across the country, sold out every game he pitched. He had one glorious year, 19 wins, Rookie of the Year, 24 complete games, led the league. Imagine that. But this glorious season was all we got. He got hurt in spring training the next year, bounced around for 4 or 5 years, but never came back, and he died this week in an accident on his farm back in rural Massachusetts.
You know, there's a lot of things different between politics and baseball. But, you know, play ball and opening day is almost like the beginning of the primaries and caucuses. It's about history. It's about lore. It's about trivia. But it's also about, I think, just about people. And, you know, I thought this would be a good way to end this week's political podcast.
And you can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ken Rudin.
And I'm Don Gagne.
Join us again next week for the triumphant return of Ron Elving on It's All Politics from NPR.
Play ball.